Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about some new developments in crypto exchanges, some of the risks that you can run into when you're implementing your blockchain or crypto project. Also, a look at some habits that can affect your financial health. Please hit subscribe to keep up with these and the latest in FinTech news. All right, let's get started. With me this week is Steve.
Hey, John. How you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Doing pretty well, pretty well.
Another busy week. Actually, they're all busy weeks when you're watching the whole world. There's always something going on, isn't there?
There's always something going on. I just talked to them in the elevators that Google reported that they're getting a lot of people looking for corona beer virus.
What?
Because people are confused about the provenance of this coronavirus thing in China. So pretty interesting.
Okay, so yeah, I guess that speaks to the declining education levels in the United States.
I think it's a combination of anxiety over this, you know, potential plague, and also just declining education levels, as you said.
And I wonder how Corona beer sales are doing then.
I don't know. That's a great question.
Yeah, but that's something that has been getting worse. It's spreading more. I saw the cities are getting locked down. Flights to China are getting canceled, and foreigners are leaving the country. And I saw some countries like have a 3-day quarantine when you leave China, so they can make sure that you're not spreading.
I also read today, or I saw today, that 3M, the company that manufactures a lot of the N93 or N92 masks, may see increased profits next cycle, or next quarter, rather.
Yeah. I saw something about some masks, the face masks, getting sold out in some places.
Yeah. I have a little bit of a trivia for you.
What
do you think 3M stands for?
Oh, it's minerals mining and manufacturing.
Close. Minnesota manufacturing and mining, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, the coronavirus had an effect on the markets as well. I saw there was a big dip in the Dow and around the world. The Chinese economy is going to definitely take a hit. From whatever it would have been without this, and around the world, you know, the airlines, like we said, travel, tourism.
The cruise lines. I also heard that apparently Apple has a big supply manufacturer, or a big supplier, rather, in Wuhan as well.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah, I saw Apple closed at least one of their stores so far because of the outbreak.
And Google also, I think, closed their China office, too.
Yeah, kind of scary stuff. But hopefully all this caution will help take care of it.
Hopefully it'll blow over.
Yeah. Well, one thing that people thought would blow over but is still around are the crypto markets.
Is that still a thing?
That is. You know, there's still news out there and still developments. Obviously, a lot of things got delayed indefinitely after the big collapse in early 2018. But we're seeing a few things, should we call them green shoots? But also, I actually want to walk back a little bit my take on Japanese fintech, saying that there wasn't as many developments as you would think from a high-tech powerhouse like Japan. Because now this week, I have a story about a new cryptocurrency index coming out of Japan. Nomura Research Institute is partnering with cryptocurrency investment providers to create the NRI IU Crypto Asset Index.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what is that?
This is a crypto index based on the 5 top cryptos, and those are Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ether, Litecoin, and XRP.
And XRP, yeah.
Still around.
Good old Ripple.
Yeah, good old Ripple. So the index was designed for Japanese institutional investors so that they could have local availability and custodial services right in Japan. So there is some fintech development and forward-thinking new products coming out of Japan.
Maybe there's some products in sort of the custodial subcategory, but not as much as in the consumer-facing side, right? Because this is more of an institutional play, right? Or is this an actual consumer-facing play?
No, right. This is for institutional investors, so they can diversify and provide exposure to this asset class to their clients.
I will stand by my comments in okay. terms of their prowess.
So we mentioned previously about crypto being included in investment advisors' portfolios that they can offer their clients, and part of the reason is the return. The 1 year performance for this particular crypto index, it would have been 104.86%. So you would have, you know, doubled your money. And well, the 3 year return, I don't know if we're going to go with that because there's a big rise and fall, but still the 3 year return would have been 2,200%.
That's amazing.
So there's some attraction. And of course, an important thing in portfolio management is that it's not as correlated to a lot of other asset classes.
Right.
Which is a big plus. Also, they mentioned that there's crypto derivatives are getting more popular as well, although more popular from a very low base, and things just haven't been, haven't had the volume, which is why you don't see a lot of the explosion in products and investments that people were predicting. So one of the ways you can achieve exposure on your portfolio investments is by using derivatives to not directly buy. And in the case of Bitcoin, you know, there's issues with custody on a digital asset. So just have something that's virtually tracking. Mm-hmm. That would be more attractive and avoids that whole custody and security and getting hacked kind of issue, because it's just basing on price changes, not actually owning the asset.
So I have a very dumb question here. Can you short a crypto?
Yeah, we haven't seen a lot of short selling, mainly because you have to borrow an asset and then have an agreement to sell it in the future, which is what shorting essentially does. So you could probably do that as a private transaction, but there's another way now that you could bet on a decrease in the price of Bitcoin. Aymon AG, which is a Swiss cryptocurrency financial firm.
They're always Swiss, by the way.
They're very finance forward.
A lot of crypto stuff in Switzerland, yeah.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. They're offering an exchange-traded product that gives investors an inverse exposure to Bitcoin. And so you can bet on the price going down on the Swiss exchange through them. But still, the volumes don't seem to be there for a lot of these products. As of January 27th, the last trade that had happened on this Bakkt exchange for Bitcoin option was 11 days before.
Wow.
So not very liquid.
Yep.
So it's kind of like always like a fusion energy. It's always the energy of the future in 20 years.
It's just around the corner.
Just around the corner.
It's actually, this reminds me of my favorite band name is Weird Promise Jetpacks.
It's a band name?
It's a band from like 10 years ago, yeah.
That's such a thing, right?
It's such a thing, yeah. We were promised a liquid crypto exchange.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Yeah, the liquid part is the trick.
Yeah.
We're not seeing the volumes quite yet. So this kind of leads me into another article that looks at the risks that crypto and blockchain exchanges can expect.
There are risks?
In 2020. Besides, there's a lot of different kinds, and some we think about more or less than others. Certainly the market risk of holding, the volatility. But for implementation, especially for financial institutions, a big risk is the lack of consistency across the world and even within countries of regulation. So it's funny, they mentioned that 2020 is going to be the breakthrough year for cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and kind of like what we said, and it always will.
That's
be
always the case
in the future.
It's just around the corner, people.
So some of they mentioned some of the potential solutions to the problems with blockchain adoption, which is getting the speeds to run faster so they can be more commercial scale.
Right.
The wide adoption and the volatility of the prices, which makes it difficult to use as a medium of exchange.
So how do we fix those things?
Yeah, right. So they mentioned a few things. So there's off-chain protocols, so where the processing gets done off of the main chain, so it doesn't slow down. It's not subject to that that long lag time. At one time, it was like 15, 20 minutes or more.
20 minutes, which by the way...
Yeah, there's some long delay.
Compared to Visa or something, or the regular payment rails, that's basically a millisecond.
Right. And this is at the current levels. And just imagine times 1,000. I mean, it would just slow to a crawl.
Yeah.
And so that's what the off-chain protocols are trying to do. Mm-hmm. So volatility, one of the answers is the stable coins, stable assets, tying it to a fiat currency.
Makes sense, yeah.
And
Wait, does that mean we should all be on Libra?
Oh,
I can't wait. I heard today that another partner just dropped out. I'm not sure who, but
from last week?
Yes. Another one.
Okay, another one.
This is a bit off topic, but it's actually a really good opportunity for another company with maybe less baggage than Facebook to
maybe,
go up with a similar product.
Maybe Gemini.
Maybe, yeah, Gemini can do that.
Those Winklevoss twins can save us from Facebook.
They're in a new book.
They failed the first time.
Yeah.
So.
Gotta do it again.
Yeah. And the third thing they mentioned is as far as developments for wider blockchain usage is improving the on and off ramps. And we've talked about some people trying to make solutions going back and forth from fiat currency to cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, I think
like using it on your card or your phone or whatever and just buying things
easily. We mentioned
easily.
Last week that I believe Square is working, or Square was granted a patent to basically convert fiat currencies to crypto and back and forth in a mobile setting. So this makes sense.
So those sound all good, except for those risks, those pesky risks.
Those damn risks.
Yeah, and we saw that. So you think stablecoin, that's going to solve the problem. But as we saw with Tether, the trust of the institution that's managing the currency becomes very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And once, how many times is it going to be that something gets broken into or there's fraud committed and you just stop using that on and off ramp with that stablecoin because it's just not reliable enough? So that's a huge risk. We've seen the breakdown in security over and over again. I love these acronyms. We were talking about 310 last week.
Sure.
And I haven't really heard DeFi too much.
DeFi?
Is it DeFi or DeFi?
Is it DeFi?
It's decentralized finance.
Oh. Okay. Great.
I heard that one, but
that's a new term. Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna try to talk all in acronyms and jargon.
Yeah.
We're gonna have an episode just talking like that.
It'll be lovely to listen to.
Yeah. So trust is an issue for decentralized finance to expand. So we saw a huge drop off in Bitcoin after the Mt. Gox break-in in 2014, for example.
Mm-hmm.
2014, that's
the
world
like,
moves
yeah.
so fast.
That's 4,000 years ago.
Yeah. You know, if it said 1997, I would have believed it. You know, but seems like ages. And a lot of the compliance has been an issue, too. Like I said, there's no consistency. A lot of the regulations have focused on KYC, AML, which is Know Your Customer, anti-money laundering, kind of avoiding crimes. But that's just one aspect of regulation. There's so many ways, as every large bank knows, there's so many ways to get in trouble with the regulators. And it's worse if you're working with cryptocurrencies. They don't have national borders. So you can't really promise that things will stay within a certain jurisdiction. So you might be subject to multiple regulations under different regimes, regulatory regimes. And so this is causes confusion and a question of interpreting what the rules should be, when they're overlapping. I mean, even if you build that kind of thing into the blockchain, like a smart contract to comply.
Right.
I mean, if the rules aren't clear what you're supposed to do, you can't really program it in, right?
Yeah. So this is somewhat interesting if you're a huge dork like I am, but I was listening to a podcast about ISDAs recently, right? Which are ISDAs.
Well, I forget what they stand for, but it's the derivative agreements that you do so that you can trade with everybody else.
Essentially that, yeah. And one component of an ISDA agreement is that the two parties have to agree on the jurisdiction that will have compliance and regulatory oversight over the contract. So, you know, kind of gets to the point that agreeing on a set of rules is really important to making finance work.
Yeah, that's a big deal for interoperability between in the financial world. ISDA.
Yep.
So yeah, a lot of the. As usual, lots of stuff to think about in there.
Lots to unpack in there.
A lot can go wrong. That's the answer.
Yeah, a lot can go wrong, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of things going wrong, what do you think was the average household income, inflation adjusted, in 1959 in the U.S.?
In 1959, it was $29,312.
Wow. How did you know
that? $0.83.
It's pretty close. It was $29,000. And now I think it's something close to 69,000 maybe. But anyway, it's interesting because we used to have less earning potential 50 years ago, 60 years ago, but we had a much higher savings rate. And that actually has, and it's that rate has declined precipitously in the past 4 decades.
So people used to make a lot less money, even like adjusted for purchasing. They could buy less stuff. And they still had a much higher savings rate.
They could buy less stuff, but they would also save a lot more stuff.
So are you saying we need 15 years of depression and world war to kind of calm people back down to appreciate, hey, I can just afford food. I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good right now.
I don't know that we need that. I think we just need a different approach to saving and sort of to approach in which we think about our financial health. So,
consumerism is just...
Consumerism is...
I mean, you're just raised to buy from day one.
Well, we're...
That's not a complaint, by the way.
I have way too many sneakers. you may be guilty of this. I know that I am. Whenever I go to the gym, say for like an hour, I feel like I can just eat whatever I want. And I, you know, will have maybe a slice of pizza, maybe a beer at home, and just sort of you erase all your gains because you have this perception that you're doing something good for yourself, which then by doing something bad you can kind of cancel them out.
But that's so you're saying you save a nickel and you spend a dollar?
Exactly. So that's basically what we're doing, is that as our incomes have risen, so has our spending. So this is based on a blog post, but they're saying how in the 1950s it was perfectly fine to go on vacation to a campsite. That was totally fine. It was completely fine to wear hand-me-downs and to buy used clothing or used items. It was fine for your house to be under a thousand square feet. Not the case anymore. I think we've all heard of the study, you know, the famous one from the Fed maybe 2 years ago, that 1 in 5 Americans couldn't come up with $400 for some sort of financial emergency. That was not the case 6 years ago because we're better at saving money than we are now. And essentially, all of our consumer habits have led us down this path where we, even though our incomes have grown again significantly, almost doubled, we have also decreased our savings rate and increased our spending.
So our income has more than doubled, but our wants have quadrupled
or even at more least. Than that. Yeah, yeah.
And easy credit card usage and loans, instant microloans.
All of that stuff.
We talk about all the time.
We do, yeah. So we actually have some real data on this. So the household savings rate fell by 30%, even though the household income rose 40%. So again, decreasing what we save, increasing what we spend, even as we get more money, and that leads to basically financial ruin. So, you know, new TVs, new appliances, bigger houses, newer clothes, fancier vacations. Everyone do it in style. Sneakers, like myself.
My God, yeah. I can't believe people waste money on sneakers. how many sneakers do you have?
I think I only have like 4, which to me is a lot.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I thought you were 4. Talking about like...
No.
More than 10.
No, God, like no. 4 sneakers and a couple of dress shoes. That's it. And boots for the winter.
Well, so you should be bragging, actually. You're relatively...
It still feels like I have too many.
Yeah, more than you need.
More than I need, yeah.
By your own definition.
I only need 2, really, but yeah. Huh. But yeah, it's pretty interesting to look at the effects that this has on your financial health. And actually, the author of this has a couple of what I thought were really, really good prescriptions for how to address this potential shortcoming.
An app.
It's not an app, actually. not an app. Yeah, it's easier than an app.
That's how we make it out to be.
That's how we make it out to be, yeah. Right. You're lonely, sad, anxious, broke. There's an app for that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, just your description of how people... thinking has changed so much and I can't help thinking of all the consumerism and the advertising that's really rocketed that those desires upwards.
Incredible.
Can you imagine just making your food at home, you know, buying vegetables and eating better, you know, because it's homemade. You save thousands of dollars and that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And hand-me-down clothes and keeping things until they get worn out and... that's a very different lifestyle from the modern American Idol, you're going to be a star.
It's not America. What we're primed to do. No, absolutely. But we actually do know what you can do to improve your situation.
Play the lottery.
Play the lottery is a big one. Have rich parents. No, those are not options for most people. But one is actually that, you know, you should be able to maintain your spending as your income grows. So sort of, you know, as your career progresses, you, of course, get more income. But there's always a trap of, hey, I'm making more money now. I should spend more money or buy nicer things for myself. Don't do that. Just maintain your spending habits, keep them at level, and then use that savings, or rather use that delta to either invest or put it into a savings account. That's number one.
Okay. I can't do that. So what else you got?
So money is often a negative art. So basically,
negative art.
Yeah. So how much wealth you have is as incumbent as to what you don't do as it is as to what you do. So again, stop buying stuff because you get more, don't spend more stuff. Just if your lifestyle works for you, even if you get an influx of cash, just keep on trucking, keep on keeping on.
Yeah. That does remind me of people who do win the lottery. What is it? In 5 years,
they're usually broke.
Some 40% file bankruptcy or some.
Yeah.
Because they feel like,
I have this money.
I saw one where the guy thought, well, the exact opposite of your advice, and he ran into trouble. He thought, well, I'm a millionaire now, so my daughter's wedding should now be scaled up by some crazy, he spent some insane amount.
We need elephants. On it.
And they would have done, because I'm a millionaire, so this is what a millionaire's daughter's wedding should be like.
Right.
Kind of buying into the hype and the TV show and, you know, what people are telling you rather than,
It's true. And the very last one here, and I feel like an ancient person saying this, but a penny earned or a penny saved really is a penny earned. What you pay for
plus
now.
Plus interest.
Not everything's price is really clear. So, you know, maybe splurging on that thing that you buy now will have effects on your savings 10 years from now. So I know that actually, I think Wealthfront does this now, where if you initiate a withdrawal, it'll tell you, you know, if you keep it in your account, this is how much it would be in 20 years or so.
Yeah,
so
right. I love that. I remember seeing something like that. If you put like a dinner, $100 dinner on a credit card, it ends up costing you like $184.
Exactly. If you pay the minimum balance,
Right. If you end up paying all the interest and rolling it over again and again. So.
Right. So basically think of the pricing not only in real terms and in current terms now, but also in future terms. If you make this purchase now, how will that affect your ability to save money or invest your money 5, 10, 20 years from now?
And you can't really say, you know, before you could always say like education, it's a great investment. But these days, it's so expensive. If you go to a private university or college,
especially
and you could be underwater for a long time. I mean, when I was growing up, you do anything to get your university degree because then you're set.
Because you're going to be fine. You're entered the middle class.
Of course, if you go to a state school, there was like, I guess the equivalent today of like $500 a semester, a quarter. And now it's some thousands.
Which is still much cheaper than a private school. Yeah.
Which is still much cheaper. And you could still get into a lot of debt. Just on that. So even the old good long-term investment type of things may not.
It sounds boring.
Make sense.
It's anymore. Not tech-enabled, but it's just, you know, think of what you're doing now and try to not to have your spending not exceed your earnings.
All right. I'm feeling really bad about my new Jaguar now. Oh well.
You should have bought a Prius.
I should have bought a Prius. Yeah. All right, let's get going on our final bites. What do you have for us?
So I have a very related number. I'm sort of on a financial health kick lately, and my number is 1 in 6. So before we get into this, I should know that as part of anybody's media literacy, you should always look at, when you see a study, who funded it and why they funded it.
That's always good.
Always good. This is a study funded by Vero Money, which is the fintech that's looking to help you save money. So take what they say with a grain of salt, but what they say is that in a survey they did, along with SurveyMonkey, they found that 1 in 6 Americans cannot make their monthly bill payments, which is fairly high, right? This is not just $400. This is your regular ongoing monthly bill payments.
So that means some portion of those are borrowing to pay some bill.
Maybe putting them on a credit card or something. I don't know.
Right. To keep their car payments going or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Get the credit card going or their house, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, Vero has, I'm sure, some sort of tool to help you address that. But
this is a recent survey.
The results were released just last week, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So this is in an economy with 3.5% unemployment.
I think. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, an ideal economy, and you're still kind of struggling. This is a that's not encouraging.
So imagine when shit hits the fan.
Right. Yeah, it can only get worse from here.
What's your number, John?
All right, my final bite is 743 million, and that's the number of transactions completed on Zelle in 2019.
That's a whopping number. Isn't Zelle like a Venmo-like thing?
Yeah, right, right. It's the digital payment structure between the largest banks. Actually, the I didn't know this, but the owner of Zelle, or the organization between these seven largest banks, is called Early Warning Systems LLC. So the big banks all pitched in and created this
consortium of sorts.
This, they call themselves a fintech, but you know, they're really the incumbent banks.
Sure.
To identify and authenticate payments, so they could work between themselves and head off competitors like Venmo and Cash and all that stuff.
And Zelle actually works through your mobile banking app that you have now. If you have a big bank, I think it can be its own app as well, but it can also work with your banking. If you want to send me money, for example, with your Citibank to my Chase or something, that's via Zelle. Even though it may not be Zelle branded.
It's kind of like built into your...
Exactly.
Actually, it does say Zelle.
Oh, does it?
In the app that I have, actually.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of like built in, kind of seamless in with your mobile banking app.
Awesome.
Are there... You know, I haven't seen smaller companies use Zelle. Is it restricted to the largest banks?
I don't know if that's the case, but I think this is a pretty good... I think there's a good business case here for having maybe Zelle for commercial relationships as well. So the businesses can invoice and pay each other via Zelle. It would make sense.
Yeah.
But what do I know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people use Zelle just because it is the largest banks in the United States that use it. They say in this press release that the 1 in 2 U.S. adults with a bank account have Zelle in their mobile app.
Apparently, it's also growing as a way for people to give each other birthday presents. So that I can give you a present with Zelle, or you know, grandma can send me $20, or whatever, and it'll be via Zelle and not via the old paper check.
Yeah, right. People do that, and of course they encourage that, right? Gifting, splitting costs, like roommates, or for some present like that. Yeah, sure.
Rent payments too. That would make sense for Zelle if you can pay your landlord if you're renting your apartment via Zelle as well. Avoid checks, avoid ACH, or just pay via Zelle.
Because there's no cost to that, right?
Yeah, no.
So if you do like a... nobody wants to take credit cards for rent because it's huge, 2.5%, 3%, whatever.
It's huge, yeah.
Yeah, it's like...
And checks are like, who has a checkbook anymore? It's terrible, so yeah.
Yeah. You get paid much quicker. You can just do Zelle. So, yeah.
Zelle for rent payments. Call Zelle me Zelle. I got ideas.
Yeah, go Zelle, I guess, if you're not one of their competitors.
That's right. Go Zelle and go Giants.
Yeah.
I mean, Niners. Show some how much I care. Go Niners.
Go Dodgers, you mean?
Go sure. Yeah.
All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news. And thanks for listening.
See you later.